Blog Talk Radio.
I am the nation. I was born on July 4th, 1776, and the Declaration of Independence is my birth certificate. The bloodlines of the world run in my veins because I offered freedom to the oppressed. I am many things and many people. I am the nation. I am 200 million living souls and the ghost of millions who have lived and died for me. I am Nathan Hale and Paul Revere. I stood at Lexington and fired the shot heard round the world. I'm Washington, Jefferson, Patrick Henry. I'm John Paul Jones, the Green Mountain Boys, and Davy Crockett. I'm Lee and Abe Lincoln. I remember the Alamo, the Maine, and Pearl Harbor. When freedom called, I answered and stayed until it was over there. I left my heroic dead in Flanders fields and in the steaming jungles of Vietnam. I am the Brooklyn Bridge, the wheatlands of Kansas, and the granite hills of Vermont. I am the coal fields of the Virginias and Pennsylvania, the fertile lands of the West, the Golden Gate and Grand Canyon. I sprawl from the Atlantic to the Pacific. 3 million square miles. I'm more than 3 million farms. I'm forest, field, mountain, and desert. I'm quiet villages, and I'm cities that never sleep. You can look at me and see Ben Franklin walking down the streets of Philadelphia. I'm Babe Ruth in the World Series. I'm 130,000 schools and colleges and 326,000 churches where my people worship God as they please. I'm a ballot dropped in a box. I am an editorial in a newspaper, and I'm a letter to a congressman. I'm Thomas Edison, Albert Einstein. I'm Horace Greeley, Will Rogers, and the Wright brothers. I'm George Washington Carver, Daniel Webster, and Jonas Salk. I'm Walt Whitman, Thomas Paine, Tom Sawyer, and Walt Disney. Yes, I am the nation, and these are the things that I am. I was conceived in freedom, and God willing, in freedom I'll spend the rest of my days. May I possess always the integrity, the courage, and the strength to keep myself unshackled, to remain a citadel of freedom and a beacon of hope to the entire world. I am the nation.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Patriot Education. My name is Terry Rowland, and I'm your hostess for this evening. As always, we are brought to you through the good offices of the great folks at www.patriotfamilies.com, people who believe in this nation and understand that they are the nation. I hope everybody's had a warmer January, beginning of February than I have. Here in Virginia, we're not used to temperatures below freezing every night and down into single digits, but being tough and Virginia being the mother of presidents, we survive. Tonight's topic, ladies and gentlemen, is the data-driven mania. Our federal government, through the Department of Education, has set up a paradigm for public education that relies incredibly heavily on standardized testing and standardized education for our children to learn the things they need. Unfortunately, this method of focus is telling our children that the most important skill they will ever learn is how to take a test. I can give you an example that occurred in my in-school suspension room this week. I had a seventh grade student who has great difficulty with reading. This student was told by the reading specialist who works with him that he needed to look at the questions about a reading passage before he read it, and then look for key words in the passage that matched words in the question, and then figure out the answer that way. Well, for this particular student, whose reading skill is extremely far below his grade level, this strategy will help him on such things as standardized tests. But it will not improve his reading. It will not broaden his knowledge, because what he is doing is the equivalent of hunt and peck on a keyboard instead of learning how to touch type. Unfortunately, I had a couple of other students who were using this same advice to avoid reading the material at all. They looked for a group of words or a key word and then attempted to copy down the sentence in which they found it as the answer to a question. Unfortunately, it wasn't working because the questions required them to make connections between an entire paragraph and the question that was asked. And when I explained to these two students that they could not approach the material in this way, the child who had been given this advice popped up with, "Well, you're wrong. My teacher told me to do it the other way." And I had a very difficult time explaining to him that strategies that helped him might not be appropriate for other students who needed to develop skills that he hadn't yet achieved. So I took the time the next day to talk with his reading teacher and let her know what had occurred so that when it came up in her session with him, she could explain to him that everybody learns in different ways, and what skill works for him or tactic works for him might not work for someone else. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the climate that data-driven, standardized everything has led to. It is that data-driven, standardized approach to education that puts a child like this, who has great difficulty with learning, into classes with students who are average or above average in skills. And unfortunately, what happens is that the students who are average or above drop their ability to understand to the level of the student who, through no fault of his own, cannot comprehend the material at this grade level. I was substitute teaching today, ladies and gentlemen, in a seventh grade history class that was going over the Jazz Age, the Roaring Twenties, and the Great Migration, and the influence of the Harlem Renaissance on music and art in American culture. The students in each of the four periods I taught managed to stay focused and listen and pay attention for approximately 40 minutes. And part of the lesson was viewing, at the end of doing some notes and writing things down about the people who were mentioned in the classwork, they were to watch a couple of video clips, examples of the music from composers like Duke Ellington, Aaron Copland, and George Gershwin, and view art by Georgia O'Keeffe, and stories or tales or background on the novels of people like F. Scott Fitzgerald and John Steinbeck. Well, the minute video was heard, everybody in class started chit-chatting back and forth, playing with things on their desk, throwing papers at each other, because video means I don't have to pay attention because it's a video. Again, data-driven, standardized education. Technology is a wonderful thing, and I thoroughly enjoyed the videos I showed because I got to listen to Take the A-Train by Duke Ellington's orchestra and Sing, Sing, Sing by Benny Goodman's and Rhapsody in Blue by Gershwin. But these children had absolutely no ability to appreciate this because their education has been about passing the test. And if they're shown a YouTube video or whatever, because it isn't going to be on the test, they assume, then their attention and their focus goes totally out the window. 11, 12, and 13-year-old children, ladies and gentlemen, are not adults. They cannot relate to historical time because they haven't lived long enough to understand that the stretch between June and Christmas isn't 12 years long. They have no understanding of how the study of history and the people who made it can give them insights into their own world, their music, their art, their entertainment, because it has grown from those roots. But if it isn't going to be on the test, they're not going to make that connection. They're not going to explore or discuss or ask the kind of questions that the children in the classes I taught today asked when I was talking about Georgia O'Keeffe, John Steinbeck, the Jazz Age, the great migration of Southern blacks to northern cities, and the effect it had not only on music and art and literature, but on the ability of the white people of the time, the young people who had seen their parents' generation create a war that killed millions and advanced nothing, and who decided that if that's the way I'm going to go, I'm going to have as much fun as possible, got to see and hear the music of a culture that otherwise they would have totally avoided, and how that influenced the civil rights movement and the equal opportunity laws and the legislation of the New Deal during the Great Depression and the music that developed from the migration from the drought-starved Midwest to California, and how it got into the movie industry and played a part in everybody in this nation and all around the world learning about blues and jazz and its rhythms and its soul. My friend Linda just arrived in the chat room. She was late to class. I guess I'm going to have to give her detention in ISS. But it's good to see everybody who's in chat with us tonight, my friend Nick, my friend Linda, and I'm pretty sure other members of the Patriot family will be joining us. But I wanted to talk about my experience today because it had its good side. That 20 minutes in which attention went away was balanced by 40 minutes of children listening and learning something, and asking questions. Strangely enough, the same child who had disagreed with the idea that you need to actually read something and not just for hunt for keywords was in one of those classes today. And I was talking about the Dust Bowl and the migrant workers, about whom Steinbeck wrote in The Grapes of Wrath, and that these folks had lost everything, and they had to leave everything familiar behind and travel from town to town and state to state just to find enough farm work, which is what they grew up learning to do, to feed their families. And this same child said, "You mean they really were honest?" And I said, "Yes, they were. They weren't bums. They weren't hobos. They weren't migrant workers in the sense of illegal immigrants trying to game the system. They were people whose entire world had collapsed, and they were trying to find a way to rebuild it." So that child today, because he listened, learned something. He learned that sometimes you need to dig deeper into the story to find out that some group of people that you've thought inconsequential or unimportant actually have something to teach you. And this is the antithesis of data-driven, standardized education. When I am in front of a class, ladies and gentlemen, I use every ounce of skill I possess in facial expression, in vocal modulation, in movement, in gesture, to make whatever subject I'm teaching come alive for these kids. I don't follow a script that is written in Washington by educational and business bureaucrats who assume that if you just present the Jazz Age by listing composers, authors, artists, playwrights, and make the children memorize that George Gershwin was connected with music and Georgia O'Keeffe with painting, then they will be educated and able to make connections in their own life, and that they will be the lifelong learners that we all have to be as technology grows more and more complex and more capable of doing so much for us. I was proud of myself today, ladies and gentlemen, and most of you probably are going to laugh at me because it's something that comes easy to a lot of you, especially if you're under the age of 40 and listening to this show. I managed to figure out how to download the Kindle app from Amazon onto my new Android phone. So I could read something during my lunch break because I forgot my Kindle. I didn't take it to school with me today. That's not too bad for a little old lady who was born in 1946 when cell phones and all the wonders of technology were fiction that kids read about in books by Robert Heinlein and Isaac Asimov and Arthur C. Clarke when they were in middle and high school, as I was. I have to be a lifelong learner, ladies and gentlemen, as we all do. Standardized education doesn't make lifelong learners. It makes obedient, short-term memorization-skilled test-takers. Because in the Borg Collective, the tests you take determine your position in the hive. And standardized testing and the data-driven mania of our public education system as it currently exists is grooming our children to think that if I just get the passing grade on this test, I will have a position and a place and someone will take care of me for whatever it is I do. The data-driven addiction of the Federal Department of Education, Common Core, so-called progressive education, will do more to kill this nation than any plague or EMP or invasion of privacy or data mining and by NSA could ever do. It will kill this nation's ability to adapt, create, and succeed. It might not happen overnight, like a major plague or a terrorist attack, but it will happen. It will create a nation of people who cannot learn because they have never been allowed to learn. It will make passing a test the measure of your worth. Well, I passed a lot of tests in my time at school, ladies and gentlemen, and I was very glad to pass them. But the kind of tests that I passed required me to think, not merely memorize for 2 or 3 hours and then do a total system dump after I walked out of the room. The tests that I took weren't multiple guess and yes, no. The tests that I took required me to answer questions with complete sentences or short paragraphs. The tests that I took required me to understand the concepts because they weren't word for word from the study guide. The kind of tests that I took and passed measured my ability as well as my knowledge. They didn't measure solely how good I was at narrowing down 4 possible answers to a 50-50 shot and taking a guess. I'm so glad to see our friend Bill Strong with us tonight. Bill, my love and prayers have been with you and Jolene and your whole family. And you are a treasure. Please know and believe this. Every single one of us has been thinking of you and praying for you over the last few days. And I have had no greater gift in my life than to see you here in the chat room tonight. All of us, ladies and gentlemen, have to be strong enough to face the rocks and stones and stumbling blocks and walls and muddy ditches that life will throw at us. And the way our lives go is not data-driven. There isn't a punch card that will guarantee us success in every endeavor. There is no testing schedule that can predict what out-of-the-box idea we might come up with that would put an end to cancer or give us the opportunity and the ability to travel beyond our own solar system and visit stars and planets hundreds of light years away without making colony ships or even with them. I told my students today that history is about people. And every single one of us makes history by being alive. Because every single one of us influences everyone with whom we come in contact. Not because we have been put into a slot in a beehive to carry pollen from one flower to the other, or produce millions of young bees, or kill a rival female so that we are queen. We do not follow a data-driven plan, ladies and gentlemen. We follow the human spirit. And we follow that creative energy, whatever you call it, that gave us our human spirit and our soul. Data-driven, machine-like educational policies will not allow our humanity, our individuality, our creativity, our desire to explore that which we have never encountered before, to bloom, blossom, and make our world better. It will only create a prison planet in which each and every human being is judged based on whether or not he or she fits into a specific slot in this new world order of the Borg Collective. Most of you who are listening have probably heard me before, and I know I'm probably repeating myself, but what I believe to be the case with our public education system and what I foresee as the result of our public education system is worth repeating. Just like the British are coming, was worth repeating to rouse the embattled farmers of Lexington and Concord. And the constant broadsheets of Thomas Paine. And the speeches and the writings of people like Alexander Hamilton, George Wythe, Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, Sam Adams, John Adams. These people, these human beings who created the framework for our nation were and had to be lifelong learners, ladies and gentlemen. Many of them were self-educated. They were taught at home or in dame schools how to read, and they took off from there. There weren't any collaborative classes and special education self-esteem building, and individualized educational plans that told them they could get up and walk out of a classroom whenever they felt like they wanted to throw a desk. Or that they could start cursing and everyone would have to put up with it because they couldn't help it. They had a disability. Nope. They were lifelong learners. And they wanted to create a nation of lifelong learners, which is why they all believed in creating public education, so that everyone who had a desire to learn would have the opportunity to do so, no matter what his family's background, social position, economic status, race, color, creed, whatever, no matter what. I spent a lot of time today in the four classes that I taught about the Harlem Renaissance, making connections to how we see one another based on the changes in our society that resulted from the great migration of southern blacks to northern cities, the Harlem Renaissance of writers and artists and musicians, and the creation of the American music and literature and art. When you look back at that time and understand that the Great Migration from 1916 to roughly 1930 occurred because freed slaves were still slaves, even though they were no longer legally owned, they were still working for absolutely nothing, sharecropping, making not enough to allow their children to have time to learn, because they were needed in the fields to harvest crops of which their families, their parents, got maybe 10 or 20% of the value. They needed to find a better way for themselves and for their kids, because they knew that the key was to have enough so that their children could be better off than they were. So they went to places like New York, Boston, Chicago, Cleveland, Philadelphia, Baltimore, where there were jobs available. They were still relegated to servants' positions, waiters, waitresses, custodians, maids, housekeepers, child's care. But they got paid enough in their wage and their tips if they worked in a big hotel or a restaurant that they could send their kids to school or pay somebody who was a musician to teach their talented youngster how to become the next Louis Armstrong or the next Duke Ellington or the next Bessie Smith. And with them, they brought the traditions of black music, jazz, gospel, and blues. And in the evening, after their shifts had ended, 12:30, 1 o'clock at the hotels and restaurants, they could go home to Harlem and go to the clubs, like the Cotton Club, and hear this music. And so could the rich white folks in New York. The rich young people who wanted to break away from a generation that gave them World War I and the first weapons of mass destruction with gas attacks on soldiers and millions of dead over a patch of ground that no one could use for 20 or 30 years after the war had passed over. And they heard this music and they liked it. And they began to recognize that what mattered about a human being was talent and ability and not color. And that music, which had been peculiar to Harlem and the folks who brought it up with them and built on it, began to spread out of the cities and into the smaller cities and into the rural areas with a huge leap forward in technology that gave us radio and movies, and transportation that would take us into the city to go to a club. And slowly but surely, we began to be aware that being an American meant being someone who could appreciate that which was new and different and take it for their own and build on it to make things better for everyone. I did that kind of connection today in those seventh grade history classes, not because I had a script from a bureaucrat in D.C., or Richmond for that matter, but because I have a passion for history and for teaching, and because the greatest gift I can give to a student is a piece of knowledge or an idea that they had never dreamed existed, and that they can absorb and take further than I can see, because they are making history and will make history. And it may be that 100 years from now, people will be reading about and studying some of those kids in some of those seventh grade classes, because something I said struck a spark, or opened a door, or gave them an idea. we listen to and enjoy and recognize Rhapsody in Blue from United Airlines commercials, almost 100 years after it was written and performed. We still read and enjoy and gain knowledge about the human condition from William Shakespeare, who lived 500 years ago. We make history, ladies and gentlemen, not only by what we do, but by what we think. And no Borg collective can make history in that way. Borg collectives can only make history by destruction, ladies and gentlemen, not by creation. Data-driven education is about passing tests. Life is sometimes about passing tests too. But the tests that life gives us are very rarely multiple choice that you can narrow down and take a good educated guess when you get a 50-50 chance. The tests that life gives us call on all of our abilities, what we feel, what we think, and what we've experienced, our intuition, our practical knowledge, our courage, our inner compass of what is right and wrong. And none of these things can be taught by relying on 6 tests in a 6-week period, so that you can have numbers on paper for your child that the progressive establishment can use to slot him or her into the niche the progressives feel suits them. I am passionate about what I do, ladies and gentlemen, which is probably why I still do it, even under the conditions that teachers are asked to perform. Teachers spend more time on paperwork, test prep, and tracking for each student they teach than they do with teaching. The state legislature of Virginia is reviewing changes to the way that Virginia schools are required to test. From an article I read, thanks to a friend who put it on Facebook today, both sides of the political aisle are looking at reducing the number of standardized tests and giving teachers more opportunity to teach. And I am praying hard that they will also be looking at Common Core and the scripted education that it provides. My friend Linda says praise God to that, and I agree, and I am hoping and praying that progress will be made, because there is a consensus that teachers under the current system are not teaching anything except test-taking skills and how to follow a script. I have always taken delight in learning. That's why I was so tickled pink and proud of myself and walking 10 feet off the deck when I figured out how to use a new piece of technology. My old phone was a flip phone that could have been, you know, something that they dug up with Tyrannosaurus Rex, given the generational nature of science and technology advancement nowadays. But I figured out how to get something I wanted onto my new one. I did it myself, using my brain and my knowledge of other types of technological work, like what I've learned about computers. And I taught myself. I got manual. I talked to people because I wanted to know how to use this stuff for myself, for my job, for my family. I wanted to know. So, because I was taught how to learn, I was able to do it. I was lucky enough, ladies and gentlemen, to be born at a time when teaching and learning went together. I was lucky to be raised in a family where knowledge was valued for its own sake and not just for a grade on a report card or a mark on a test. I was raised in a family that understood and taught me that a grade was a measure of mastery and achievement, not a present given to me by the teacher because he or she liked my hairstyle or I emptied the wastebaskets for them for a week and a half. I grew up in a climate, both at school and at home, where knowledge was the opportunity to go farther than my parents had. My mother had a high school education. She went through 12 years of parochial school. Her father died when she was 10 years old, and her older sister was 15. My grandmother went to work as a housekeeper and in the school cafeteria in order to pay bills and pay their tuition. My grandmother had only an eighth grade education. But she was a lifelong learner, and she taught her daughters to be. She didn't moan and complain and look to government to send them to Catholic school. She worked her butt off to make it possible for them to get the very best education they could, moral, spiritual, and intellectual. And she didn't grudge that work, because to her, that was a responsibility. That was what parents did. They didn't look to government to raise their children. They didn't look to government to clothe them, feed them, teach them, give them grades, and guarantee them success. They looked to themselves. Like those migrant workers who picked up and packed up what little they had when they'd lost everything, and didn't go to Washington to sit in the lobby of Congress and say, give me. They went to work wherever they could find it. And they made dresses out of flour sacks and shoes out of pieces of old tires. And they tied their jeans with a piece of rope because they couldn't afford to buy a belt. But they understood what it meant to want something and work toward achieving it. They weren't data-driven, ladies and gentlemen. They didn't do those things because a set of tests said that this was what you had to do to get this job or this government assistance or so on and so forth. They did it for the same reason that the black folk from the South moved to the northern cities. They wanted a better future for their children than the one they saw where they were. They wanted their children to be able to learn and grow and improve not only their own lives but the lives of others. Our children today see their time in school as worthless unless they're having fun. A social climate in which to text back and forth and discuss who's going out with who or whose best friend said what to whose other best friend and who fought with who. And listen to kumbaya moments about how it's not nice to bully people. And have extracurricular activities like band and sports and music and art. They have never learned, as my generation learned, that school was a place to gather knowledge, to to put new stuff in your head and keep it there. I never, ever, ever had a teacher tell me that I didn't need to know something because it wasn't going to be on a test. But God help us, I've heard teachers say that to their classrooms. I have told my students, every time I have them in my clutches, that one of the few things they could say that would get my dander up, so to speak, is, well, I don't need to know that. I refuse to accept. I don't need to know that. And I explain to them why. I deal with an age group who are just beginning to take the first steps on the road to adulthood. They are not adults. They are not mature. They think they are. They want all the privileges of adulthood, but have no concept that there are responsibilities attached. This is a difficult lesson to learn, ladies and gentlemen. And our schools are not teaching it. They are not teaching our children that you get what you pay for, in the sense that your effort buys you that knowledge that you are going to be expected to know and know how to use when you do finally achieve your age of majority and have, by law, those adult privileges. Because consequences are being removed. I've mentioned it before, but it's something I need to repeat, just the way Paul Revere and Billy Dawes did with the British coming. My in-school suspension classroom has strict rules. And these are those rules. Remember, my classroom is a punishment. My classroom is a consequence for inappropriate behavior. These are the rules as I express them to my students when they walk in the morning for a day of ISS. Number one, there is no talking. Number two, if you need help, need to visit the restroom, or you do not feel well, you must raise your hand and wait to be called upon before you speak. And if I am helping another student or speaking to another student, that's not a signal that everybody chimes in with what they think. You still have to raise your hand and wait to be called upon before you can express your insights or opinions. Number three, all the work given to you by your teachers is required, and you must do it. But I will help you with anything that you do not understand. All you have to do is raise your hand and ask. Number four, I expect you to remain in your assigned seat. And if I ask you to change seats, I expect you to do so quickly and courteously. Number five, any behavior that goes against the ISS rules will get you sent to the principal's office, where you will receive a referral, your parents will be called, and you will be sent home. Now this, ladies and gentlemen, in the minds of our kids, is equivalent to servitude in a Roman galley chained to an oar. It's horrible. And the funny thing is, some of you are probably old enough to remember, these were the rules of every classroom when I was in school. Every single classroom basically was my ISS room. And I can tell you for a fact that my soul has not been crushed, my self-esteem has not been destroyed, my confidence has not been eroded. I am not a quivering mass of fears and insecurities because my classrooms had these rules. I have no difficulty expressing my opinion, obviously. You all are kind enough to keep coming back week after week to listen to me do it. I have never felt inferior to anyone based on anything about me. Less knowledgeable, less of an expert in areas like, oh, how to work with car engines, and believe me, that is a closed book and I'd rather learn Sanskrit, or how to build a greenhouse with the plans all in my head, which my husband could do, or nuclear physics, which I don't understand and probably never will. But that doesn't make me sit back in a corner and tell myself I'm stupid and worthless and unable to do anything. And it doesn't have me grab my phone and run to the nearest person and say, here, fix this for me. Because all of that horrible, rule-bound classroom life that I had through school didn't crush my spirit. It allowed me to develop as far as my abilities, my skills, my interests, and my effort would take me. Those rules that are so horrible gave me the foundation to be the lifelong learner that I am. Those horrible rules, those soul-destroying, restrictive, Victorian rules, taught me that my desires sometimes had to take second place to the learning atmosphere. They taught me that if I didn't study and I didn't work, I was not probably going to pass the test on fractions that was coming up at the end of the week. Those rules taught me that when someone else was speaking, I needed to listen to them until they were finished, and then I could express my agreement, disagreement, or additions to what they said. Taught to treat other folks the way I wanted to be treated. I was taught that when I was in the classroom, my job was to open my eyes and my ears and close my mouth so that I could gain knowledge from someone who had way more of it than I did and who could help me if I ran into trouble with something, because not only was it their job, it was their delight to do so. I wasn't crippled or maimed or damaged by those rules, ladies and gentlemen. I was taught by them. There has been a mass exodus that has begun away from public education all through this nation. People are looking to other options than the public schools. Private schools, parochial schools, homeschooling, online schooling. Because so many parents out there are discovering what their children are not being taught. And because they are parents, and because they love their children, and because they understand that those children are dependent upon them for their start in life, for the development of their character, and the understanding that freedom and responsibility go together. They have looked for ways to teach their children what they need to know, not only academically and intellectually, but morally, ethically, spiritually, behaviorally, and socially. Something else came up in my substituting today. One of the major problems that we have in our schools, especially from middle school through high school is the incredible noise that our children are making. And I mean that quite literally. As they change classes or go to lockers or eat lunch in the cafeteria, the noise level is so high that children have been missed by their parents waiting to pick them up in the front lobby because the noise in the classroom was so loud they could not hear the announcement that their parents were waiting for them and they were to come to the office to go home. They scream at one another. Conversational volume doesn't exist. And it isn't just middle school. It's high school, too, because I've worked there, too. Part of it is everybody has got earbuds stuck in their ear, and they can't hear you unless you scream louder than whatever music they've got turned up to the highest volume. But part of it is the inability to connect with someone else unless you are raising your voice to absurd levels and talking over them. Some days when I have to substitute in class, I come home with a sore throat because I literally have to shout to try to get them to be quiet long enough to hear instructions. When you have 25 12-year-olds all talking at once at the top of their lungs, it's extraordinarily difficult to try to teach them anything. When I was in school, the shouting and screaming was for the playground, not the classroom or the hallways. Now, obviously, we weren't marched to and from classes in lockstep with gags over our mouths. There was a lot of whispering going on, and there was a lot of extraneous talking, and somebody was always in the principal's office for talking too much in class. I was even put behind the piano in kindergarten because I was talking during class, and that was the punishment at the Catholic kindergarten I attended. Kids talk, and they talk whenever they feel like it. But kids can be taught when it's appropriate and when it's not. And they can be taught to use their inside voices. As they used to say on Romper Room, and they still say in kindergarten. But it's not going to happen if nobody ever actually does it. I am not an advocate of Jane Eyre's boarding school, ladies and gentlemen. I don't want to return to the Victorian era of children should be seen but not heard, locked away in the nursery wing so they couldn't disturb the parents' activities, fed separately, trotted out to bow politely to a guest, and then trotted back to the nursery wing again. I'm not that much of a retrograde reactionary. But I would like to see courtesy and good manners addressed. About 20, 25 years ago, kids began to operate on a very strange maxim, theory, or presumption that being polite was somehow demeaning, that it was being servile and crouching and scaredy cat to say yes sir or yes ma'am or no thank you or please. That somehow or other, those forms of address and speech and manners were demeaning You had to be yourself. You had to stand up for what you wanted. You had to say, give me that there cookie right now. And this somehow or other proclaimed your independence, your freedom, your right to liberty. I really, really, really would love to see Washington and Lincoln and Jefferson and a lot of our former leaders and founders dropped willy-nilly into a middle school nowadays and listen to the way they are addressed by students and the way the students address adults in general. I do not expect to be meekly bowed to and revered as if I were Jesus Christ. I don't want that kind of an atmosphere, ladies and gentlemen, but I do believe that one of the skills of adulthood that needs to be addressed when, from the time children are old enough to talk and interact with adults as more than just a burden to be carried or something to be fed. Common courtesy and the respect for others that arises from self-respect. Data-driven, test-oriented, standardized education doesn't seem to care about that. As long as you pass a test, you don't have to be reasonable to live with. You don't have to be the kind of person that other people want around. As long as you pass the test, you can be a horse's backside, an outstanding jerk, a foul-mouthed pig. But so long as you pass the test, everything's okay. It is natural, and has been ever since human beings have been around, for adolescents to test boundaries. Part of adolescence is wanting those adult privileges and having no clue about the responsibilities that go with them. Part of adolescence is experimenting with four-letter words and dirty talk and sexual innuendo to prove how grown up you are or how different you are from mom and dad. And I'm not a little kid anymore. I can say what I want. We all go through it. I did, and I'm 99% sure that everybody out there listening and all my friends in the chat room did too. Kids fall in love with obscenity and curse words at about the age of 10 or 11. And the love affair continues usually up through high school and college. And by the time they've finished that and they're out there in the real world with other human beings who aren't 12, 14, 16, 18, they figure out that F this and S-H-I-T that and all of the other things that they are used to using among their peers generally don't make them very attractive for promotion or hiring. They put it behind them. But I don't think that's happening anymore. I think we have taken it to a new level or a new depth where discourtesy, rudeness, foul language, expletives, pejorative statements, name-calling have become standard communication. Certainly is from politicians. And it's getting that way because we are not setting the kind of example or requiring our children to follow the kind of example that would allow us to treat one another with some degree of respect. I don't want someone to curse at me. I don't want someone to call me nasty names or labels because I happen to think differently, worship differently, look differently, or live differently from the way that they do. So I don't do those things. When my students in the ISS room come in, I greet them with, good morning, Miss, whatever. Good morning, Mr. Who's it? And they are addressed by an honorific and their surname throughout the entire day that they are with me. And it's amazing what that one little step back from needless familiarity does. It creates a climate where verbally, I show respect to them, and by implication, they show respect to me. Some of them ask me, how come you're not calling me by my name? And I say to them, I expect you to address me as Mrs. Rowland, so I do you the courtesy of addressing you as Miss So-and-so and Mr. Watson, because it shows respect. I expect you to respect me, so I give you respect also, because I treat people the way I want to be treated. And it works. It works. Yes, it's formal, but some degree of formality is necessary in a classroom, ladies and gentlemen. Informality only works with very young children. By the time they hit adolescence, 12, 13, 14 and up, there has to be a degree of distance, because your teacher is not your mommy or your daddy or your grandma or your grandpa. Your teacher is a mentor, an instructor, and an example. Formality doesn't have to be cold and uncaring and create a gulf or a distance. When I'm in the classroom substituting, I call the students by their first name, if I know them by name. And I use the same tone of voice that I use when I address them in ISS as Mr. Jones, Mr. Smith, Miss Watson, whatever. It's not the words alone, ladies and gentlemen. It's the voice, the manner, and the facial expression. Teachers can and should expect their students to show them respect. And administrators and parents can and should enforce this when they deal with their children's relationship with their teachers. Many years ago, my husband and I were traveling, to visit relatives, and listening to the car radio. And there was a news broadcast on. And it was about a little boy who'd gotten lost in New York City. And he was taken to the police station. And they sent out bulletins to try to find the child's parents. And in the bulletin, it says, gave the child's statistics, height, weight, hair color, eye color, probable age, name, as much as he could tell them. And it said that he was very likely from the South. And people would ask, well, how do you know this? I mean, wait a minute, what? And the police who were asked about this said, well, we knew that because he said, yes, sir, and no, ma'am. If you've ever been in New York, and if you've ever been in Virginia, and compared the way that people address you, you will understand why my husband and I started laughing hysterically at the police bulletin. When I was in school, most of my schooling was in the Midwest. Illinois, Michigan, some of it was in Massachusetts, Connecticut. I went to college in Wisconsin and in Georgia. And I was not required in my younger years to address my parents as ma'am and sir, as many Southern children are to this day. I did because to me it seemed right to do so. Because I did respect them. I did look up to them. And it made sense to me to show that in the way that I spoke to them. So when I didn't say mommy or daddy, it would be yes, ma'am, or yes, sir. I did the same thing when I was in classrooms. After I had gotten old enough and was living away from the Midwest, where it's fairly unusual. And I address my students that way. Mainly because I understand that as a teacher, not necessarily a certified classroom teacher, but a teacher, one who imparts knowledge, I have to teach by example as well as precept. And if I expect them to behave with respect toward me, I have to return that. And when they see me do it, it does two things. It makes a better climate for everyone to learn. And they see that I do what I say I will do. I don't tell them pretty lies to make them feel good. I tell them the truth. And if I make a promise, I keep it, if it's within my power. Data-driven education and standardize everything doesn't take any of this aspect of teaching into account, because you can't measure it and score it on a Scantron and give it a percentage grade. Children don't have conduct or behavior grades on their report cards anymore. They used to. I've told the story before about when my husband was in second grade, I think. He brought home a report card, and he had a D in conduct. His parents were livid. His father was a lieutenant colonel in the army. His mother was raised by a Victorian termagant. And the idea that their son, living on a military base in occupied Japan, would get a D in conduct? They were ready to skin him alive and sell his hide for a pocketbook. So his mother went to the school and wanted to speak to the teacher about it and find out just exactly how her child's conduct had fallen so low. And when she talked to the teacher and asked what my husband had done to earn this D, the teacher said, well, he kept calling me ma'am, and I'm no N-word. She was apparently from New York or New Jersey. Well, needless to say, my husband's mother went to the base commander. And the base commander called the teacher into his office. And he explained to her that in the service, servicemen's children, officer and enlisted, were expected to address adults as sir and ma'am. And if they didn't, their parents, who were serving, would be called on the carpet and receive bad notations on their service record. The teacher did not last in that on-base school. She was gone and back to the USA within about a month of this incident. There is a difference, ladies and gentlemen, between subservience and good manners. And our children are not being taught that difference. They're being taught to be vocally independent and totally intellectually, socially, financially, and morally subservient. Not a good trade. But this is data-driven education. My friend Bill says that his dad was a Navy SEAL, and Bill would have run away from home before bringing home a report card with a bad conduct grade on it. I understand, Bill. My dad was not in the service. But if I had ever brought home a report card with a bad conduct grade, I would have been up the proverbial creek without the proverbial paddle. Because my parents taught me how to behave with respect and good manners. And if I did not behave that way, it wasn't their fault, it was mine. They took responsibility for my training in that area. They didn't go to school and demand that the school let me say and act any way I wanted to because I was such a smart little girl and I deserved it. Oh, no. Of course, I never brought home a bad conduct grade. Because I wasn't interested in acting like a jerk. I was interested in learning what the teacher had to say. Now, I'm not saying, ladies and gentlemen, that I'm any paragon of virtue. I'm not. I'm about as far from sainthood as a living human being can be, I can tell you that much. But I do have some good qualities. And I was fortunate enough to grow up during a time and in a family where those qualities were encouraged and those less than good qualities I possessed were discouraged because they were damaging to myself or to others. I was never excused for bad behavior because I was, whatever, fill in the blank, tall, short, girl, smart, stupid, little, big, fat, skinny, clumsy, ugly, handsome, athlete, whatever. There was no, it's okay, you're fill in the blank with me. It was not okay for me to behave badly. Not because my parents wanted to control me and beat me into submission and make me meek and subservient and totally obedient in all ways. If they had wanted to, they wouldn't have succeeded anyway. But because they knew and they understood that they had the responsibility of teaching me how to be the very best person I could be in all ways, not just intellectually. Because they understood that the character you present to the world should be who you are. And who you are should be someone who has a positive effect on the people around you. They didn't want me to be weak and timid and cringing in fear. On the contrary, they encouraged me to try things that were difficult for me. They understood when I was afraid, and they didn't torture me or torment me with things I was afraid of. But they didn't excuse me from things that I was required to do because I was scared of something or other. Especially if what I was scared of didn't happen to be involved in it at all. I learned, because my family and my schools weren't data-driven, standardized educational institutions that put me in a little box and locked me up in there for the rest of my life, I learned how to learn. I learned how to make changes in my life. I learned how to take responsibility for my own choices and try to repair my mistakes and learn from them without whining about them or repeating them in hopes that somebody else would make all the bad consequences go away. And I loved both my parents as a child, and I loved them when I became an adult and knew them as adults. And Lord knows neither one of them was perfect. But they were honest, and they were loving, and they cared about me, not just because I reflected them, but because I was me. And they encouraged me to be myself. And never, ever, ever deny who I was in order to curry favor with anybody. Looks like Mike's on the phone. Okay. Hello there.
Hey, Terry, how are you?
I'm doing great, dear. How are you this evening?
I'm doing just fine. So I'm listening in, and I think you hit it on the outer fringes, but I didn't hear the direct phrase of parental culpability. And the reason why I bring that into the mix, look, I respect, you know, what you do. I respect all teachers. I think, like, healthcare professionals, it's a calling. And in 2014, you couldn't pay me enough to be a teacher. You see, the children's behavior at home is transcending into the schools. It was the same 200 years ago, and it's the same today. So the children are at school are just a reflection of how they're living. And today's parents, A, they're not home. B, they're working too long, too hard, both of them, mind you. And C, they are so mentally burnt out that they don't have the strength, the discipline, and they actually want you, the teacher, to discipline. And then when you do discipline, they want to sue you. So you're really in a rock and a hard place. So I think it's a lost cause, and I not just on the educational front, but on many fronts, as I've been saying on my show. And I just think that the sooner that the system collapses, one way or the other, I think the sooner that we can rebuild. Now, the second point I'd like to make, now, I know you said it works, but I want you to hold that thought for a second. So the students call you Mrs. Rowland, and then you call them Mr. or Miss. Am I correct?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. Now, the issue I have with that is, yeah, they may respect you, the person, but I don't feel they're respecting your authority. Now, let me, you know, and I say that because you did mention that you sometimes go home with a sore throat because of how loud you have to yell in the classroom. Well, that tells me that they're not respecting your authority. And I feel that by you addressing them the way they address you, you're making them equal.
Okay, Mike, stop for a second. Let me clarify something. The days that I go home with a sore throat are not the days that I am in the ISS room with the students in that room. As I mentioned, I don't know whether you heard it, when I'm in the classroom, I follow the protocol that all the teachers use and address them by their first names. When they are in the ISS room with me, I do get respect for my authority. When I'm in the classroom, I cannot use that same form of address because it isn't school policy. So I have to address them the way their teacher normally does, by their first name. And you are correct. It's not my addressing them as Mr. or Miss that puts us on equal footing. It's the classroom addressing them, not just by name, but as if they were equal to the teacher. That's where the problem lies, and I agree with your first point completely, and I've talked about it on this show before. These kids are coming into school from homes where courtesy and good manners are not being taught, and I agree with you that a lot of it has to do with families struggling to try to get all the things they want with both parents working. Nobody home to teach the manners and to talk with their children instead of just at them. You are perfectly correct there, and I too agree that the system is going to collapse, and when it does, all of these things that we're seeing, will the opportunity to do them and get away with it will disappear. That's why, even though I can see that coming, I don't give up, because somebody's going to have to rebuild afterwards. And maybe something I teach these children by example or by precept is going to give them the opportunity to be one of the rebuilders.
Well, perhaps.
It's awesome.
I just think that, see, in my day, the teachers called us either by a first name or sometimes just last name only. Hey, Johnson.
Yep.
Hey, Smith.
Yep.
Hey, Dick.
Uh-huh.
And to me, that put us, you know, lower than them. They're
mm-hmm.
the authority. We're the subservient.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that by addressing them the same as they address you, you know, perhaps there are other factors.
There are.
As to why that they respect you. And I think that's the problem the parents are doing, too. They're trying to be friends
yes.
with their children because they're so
yes.
guilty
yep.
that they're not home. So I think
exactly.
that's a problem.
It is, and I've addressed that, too, on previous shows. Parents aren't supposed to be their children's friends while the children are dependent upon them. They're supposed to be their parent. A friend is someone who shares your life experience and has common interests with you and whose company you choose to engage in. That is not a parent. A parent has to be an authority figure. They have to be a mentor. They have to be a teacher. They have to be a trainer. They also have to be a loving present and presence and a nurturer. It's a difficult job. It's one of the hardest jobs in the world. It takes courage to be a parent. It takes... a deep understanding of who you are and who you want your children to be. It takes firmness, and it takes sometimes negative consequences for inappropriate behavior. You cannot be a friend to your child until you are a parent first. If you are very, very lucky, you and your parents will live long enough to meet one another as adults and like one another as adults. I was lucky that way. I genuinely liked my mother, and I genuinely liked my father when I became an adult and knew them as fellow adults and not mommy and daddy who paid my bills. Not everybody is that lucky, granted. And in today's society, under today's political and economic climate, it's even harder to be a parent. But I do believe, because I am an optimist, and I say that over and over again, because it's my nature to live optimistically, because otherwise I'd just go home and shoot myself, and then I couldn't help anybody. I believe that what I do and what teachers do and what good parents do and what good children of good parents do will build a core of people in this nation who will be able to rebuild when the inevitable collapse occurs. If we all give up in despair and run away or hide in a bunker, one of these days there won't be anybody to come back and build a society that works. Every society in the history of mankind has risen and fallen, every single one, and it's inevitable that ours will too. But every society that has grown from the fallen one has achieved something better. We've made progress. But it's not the kind of progress that so-called progressives want. We haven't progressed to the Borg Collective, which is their idea of utopia. We have progressed to way more freedom and independence and creativity than the ancient Egyptians could have imagined. And we've killed each other and fallen down wells and died off from plagues and everything else in the process. But like every other living thing, we grow through adversity. And we are still here as a species because we have learned to adapt and change. That's why I teach. It's the broad view of why I teach. Because every society is a phoenix. It burns up and then is reborn from the ashes with new and different plumage. But we remain human beings. And it's that aspect of us, that belief that I have in that human spirit that keeps me going and keeps me teaching. And yeah, I'm crazy. But believe me, nowadays you have to be to teach.
So you feel that we are more creative than the ancient Egyptians?
No, I didn't say we were more creative. I said we have, through learning from what other people have done and why it failed, every time a society falls, other societies grow up in its place, and they usually manage to make things a little better.
I kind of have to disagree. I don't think we've learned at all because we keep repeating the same things over and over and over again. And quite frankly, I think we get more barbaric because now we have weapons of mass destruction. So instead of just wiping out an army on the battlefield, we could just wipe out entire continents. So I don't know about that. I'm not really feeling that we've improved. I think we're more barbaric than the ancients in many respects. Well, that's fine, but that's just how I see it.
Yeah, okay. And I understand that, that's Mike. Fine. And there are a lot of folks who agree with that view. You and they present a view that we all need to hear because we need to be reminded that we are innately barbaric. It's our nature. We are not angels, nor are we devils. We're a mixture of the two. And it is part of being human that we are. It is dangerous when we make the assumption that somehow or other, through governmental interference, we can be made into angels. That always bothers me. This is the major disconnect I have with most progressive thinking. Not with the do-gooder aspect or the feel-good policies or the desire of sincere believers excuse me, to help people and make things better. Those are laudable. It's this assumption that they make that all we need is bigger, stronger, more controlling government, and we can be transformed from barbarians into the new gods.
Well, see, here's why I say we're more barbaric than the ancients, because the ancients were acting out of ignorance. There was nothing prior to them. We know what they did, and we know how they failed. They had nothing to go on.
Yes,
we do,
did.
And yet we could.
Yes,
no, not really. No, they didn't have the written word.
Did.
Terry,
they
no. Not like we do. Right. They didn't have the roadmap of 4,000 years of history, 4,000 years ago, way we have.
But they did. Mike, they did have the history of what came before them.
Not really.
You
if they created history, Terry.
Yeah, but you're making the same mistake that my students do, honey. Okay. You're making the assumption that because, excuse me, people in ancient times didn't know what we know, they were really stupid. They weren't. They learned, and that's, again, the reason
I
teach.
Well, I think
and
there's
I
a
don't
difference
mean to...
between intelligence and ignorance.
Well, no, there
there's,
isn't.
There's a difference. Well, there is.
No, Gary.
Okay.
Well, there is
even
a difference.
Even in the Bible, it says, that people,
Mike,
before they knew...
Mike.
All right. Yes, Terry, you're the host. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah. Stop for a minute, honey. We only have about 30 seconds. You are correct in there is a difference between ignorance and intelligence. Intelligence supersedes ignorance because intelligence means you can learn. Ignorance means you have no knowledge. Human beings have gained knowledge for as many thousands of years as we've been here, and we will continue to do. What we do with it is always in our own hands. and I don't mean to cut you off, and next week call in and we'll continue the discussion, but it's about time for me to close the show, folks, and I want to thank everybody for being here, and thank you, Mike, so much for calling. It's always fun to talk about stuff, and I hope you all will join me next week for Patriot Education, Thursday, 6 p.m., and as always, all my love to my greatest fan. Good night, everybody. God bless.